Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's certainly no secret that homelessness is a real crisis in the Bay Area and beyond as the gap between rich and poor widens. Housing seems to be getting tighter and tighter. More people are falling into homelessness. So, what are cities doing to try to help some of their most vulnerable residents? Oakland has declared homelessness a citywide emergency. That was done back in October, and they are now beginning to erect prefabricated tough sheds. The idea is to house some people as a short-term solution to the problem. San Jose's mayor, Sam Liccardo, has proposed a village of sorts of tiny homes for his city's homeless population. In San Diego, they're setting up huge communal tents. And in San Francisco, the city's navigation centers are meant to be a stepping stone to permanent housing. But does anybody really know how to create real housing for the poor, particularly living in the midst of plenty as we do in the Bay Area? And what are some of the ideas and solutions coming straight from those who are unhoused people themselves? What works, what doesn't? Joining us for this conversation today, we have Jennifer Friedenbach. She's executive director of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness. She's worked for the coalition for 22 years. Ms. Friedenbach has a long history of community organizing and has worked on a range of poverty-related issues, including welfare rights and housing, health care, disability. And during her tenure at the coalition, she has achieved several significant victories alongside homeless people who worked with her, including the creation of a local housing subsidy, and that subsidy serves hundreds of homeless families. And she's joining us in studio, certainly an expert on the subject. Thank you so much for being here, Jennifer.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. How do you have a discussion like this without talking to somebody who's had 22 years in the trenches? We're very grateful to have your input. Also joining us, Nita B. I'm sure you've heard the name. She's the founder of Feed the People. For the past 2 years, the all-volunteer group has supported Oakland's unhoused folks caught up in the homeless state of emergency. They provide hot meals and provisions and advocacy, even legal defense. Earlier this year, Nita B. helped a group of unhoused people build their own tiny home encampment. It's called The Village. And what started as a direct action has now developed into a real movement to build villages of small homes and combine those homes with services for Oakland's unsheltered population. And Nita B. joins us by phone from the East Bay. Hello, Nita B.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having us on today.
Absolutely. And again, you can't have this conversation without you. And rounding out the trio is Andrea Erden. She's the CEO of Home First. It's a provider of services, shelter, and housing opportunities for the homeless and those at risk of homelessness in Santa Clara County. Andrea has spent her career in mental health for youth and families in Santa Clara County's highest risk communities. And Home First is tasked with trying to facilitate a tiny village in the South Bay for San Jose's homeless. And Andrea Erden joins us by phone from the South Bay. Andrea Erden, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Absolutely. This is one of those things that everybody seems to have an opinion about, because you can't drive around nowadays without seeing people living under freeway off-ramps and in tents. And we're wondering, for our listeners, what do you think of the various so-called creative ways that cities are trying to house the homeless? If you are homeless or have had that experience, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. Jennifer, I'd love to start with you. You've been working in homeless advocacy for a long time in the Bay Area. But is this a cycle? Have we seen this level of homelessness in the Bay Area before, or is this unprecedented?
You know, the amount of displacement, I think, is it just keeps getting worse, of course. But I think the big difference that's happening now is all the tents. And so we've had for a long time San Franciscans and, you know, people all up and down the West Coast that, you know, would walk over homeless people in doorsteps and on the sidewalk and maybe not give it much thought or not call the city to complain or call the police or whatever. But now with tents, it creates a big reaction from folks, and it just makes the issue so much more visible. And so that's been an interesting development. The other piece, I think, for all of us in the Bay Area is that, you know, everyone looks now at homeless people and sees, almost everyone sees themselves in homeless people's faces, because everyone is so rent insecure. So they feel, you know, they're on the verge of losing their housing, and they very well could be in that position next. And so all of this has kind of created a situation where there's just a lot more attention on the issue, a lot more calls into the city, for better or for worse, for action. And also that creates a lot of opportunity for us to do things very differently and to make a huge huge change on this issue.
A couple of things there. As you said, maybe you might have come across someone in a doorway who was homeless. So your point is that it's the actual concentration now that people are seeing, actual tent cities cropping up. So it's the concentration of homeless folks living all in one area that seems to be so evocative for people. But also the fact that that 2008-2009 crash may have given people a whole different idea about being just one paycheck away themselves, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And the tent thing really also, though, the visibility of the tents does elicit a lot more reaction from folks. And, you know, for homeless folks who are outside, of course, not having shelter, you know, your health deteriorates really rapidly. And so depending on what your, you know, it's connected directly to what your living situation is. So if you're out on the streets, your health is going to deteriorate a lot more rapid than if you're in a tent and you have just a modicum of shelter. You know, if you're in a residential hotel, you're kind of slightly a step up, but not quite as good as someone who's in safe and decent housing that may not have the environmental factors that happen in housing that's really decrepit and falling apart. And so, you know, people's health is, you know, as bad as their living situation. And what we see in San Francisco and, you know, is we have this very large unsheltered population. We also have folks that are a whole lot sicker, and they're facing a lot of trauma and destabilization, getting moved around constantly by the police. There's, you know, folks have a predisposition to any mental health issues. Those are exacerbated. They end up self-medicating with drugs and alcohols often and develop addictive disorders. Their physical health goes down really quickly. Human beings are just not meant to live outdoors.
Nita B., you're the founder of Feed the People, and you have your own experience working with homeless communities in Oakland and beyond. And you did some organizing with a group who called themselves The Village and eventually called themselves The Promised Land. Talk about the extent to which some of the addressing of the needs of the homeless has been the result of homeless folks organizing themselves into collectives like this.
Yeah, so The Village is a group of homeless and house folks working together to address this homeless crisis. Because what we know is that the reason it's a crisis is because literally any one of us at this point can be homeless. A lot of folks in the streets have full-time jobs. Most of the folks here in Oakland, California, were born and raised in Oakland, and they're now homeless in the neighborhood they grew up in. And I think part of that effort to self-organize comes, one, with the legacy of the Panthers. We're in Panthertown. And that legacy, though the Panthers are long gone, the legacy is still here, and that fire is still here. And so you have folks here in Oakland who realize what's happening, that this homeless crisis is directly related to the crisis of gentrification, and that folks are fighting. They're fighting back, even if they are living on the street. And it's really, we really do believe that it's important with any crisis, whether you're talking about homelessness or, you know, racism or sexism, that the folks most impacted need to be the ones who are leading the charge. They're the folks who know the issues of the best, and they also have the solutions for these issues. And so just like any other issue that plagues society, homelessness needs to be led by those who are homeless. And what we're seeing here in the city of Oakland, you know, everything that the city is doing at this point actually came from hardcore advocacy and direct action by both the village and the lobbying group that was created out of the village, the Homeless Advocacy Working Group. So the porta potties that we're seeing showing up, the trash pickup that's finally happening, the hand washing stations, that all came from the village and the Homeless Advocacy Working Group pushing the city. The safe haven that the city created, that basically is the institutionalized model of the village. It's really inhumane, actually. What they're putting people in are tough sheds. They're actual tool sheds with a window that's too small for even a tiny little adult to get through. They're aluminum sheds. They're not insulated. We're out here right now, actually, at the encampment surrounding the tough sheds. The city has decided that so there's only 40 beds in the tough sheds, and there's more than 100 people that live in encampments that sprawl around their safe haven.
So you're actually there now? You're right there as we speak?
We're there right now. I stepped aside because it's right under the BART and the freeway, and I couldn't hear you guys, and you guys wouldn't be able to hear me. Mm. So I just stepped inside of McDonald's right now to talk to y'all. But
is it almost complete, Nita?
The safe haven has been erected for 3 weeks, and it is not full. There's only 10 people living in there because the city built this without talking to nobody who lives out here. And the few people who live out here, they repeatedly, what we're hearing is that this is not humane. There's no running water. There's no electricity. There's one sister who's out here. She's a really powerful leader in this encampment. And she was saying, you know, I have a 3-bedroom tent. I can house me and my 2 children in this tent. We have a generator with electricity. I have a flat screen TV. I have a queen size bed. I have enough room for all my clothes and their clothes. And they're telling me that I have to give all this up to go live inside a tool shed that is uninsulated with no electricity. I have to live on a cot, and I can't even live in the same tool shed with my children because we're not allowed to. So it's a mess. It's really institutionalized. Yeah, the city has spent, it's a $1 million budget that they're using to house 40 people, and it's not filled. People don't want to move into it. And half of that budget, $550,000, is going to go to pay 4 staff people. And with the village, with our model, of course, it's totally, you know, we have showers. You can bring whatever you want. You can live with your family. You'll have electricity. You'll have a hot shower. You'll have a kitchen. And we spend $0 in what we're doing. And our entire movement is volunteer-based. And so folks want to move into villages that don't want to move into tool sheds. And it's crazy. We've been spending this whole morning, trying to advocate for folks' human rights. And folks should know that the United Nations is actually coming to Oakland in less than a month to document the human... They're agreeing and recognizing that how the city of Oakland, the police department, the city agencies, the different nonprofits that have contracts with the city are treating the homeless out here is actually in violation of their human rights. And so, you know, we've been saying this to the city of Oakland and to the police and to Caltrans for 2 years now, and they haven't listened to us. So now the UN is going to be out here documenting human rights violations.
Well, in a very timely fashion, Nita B., we have City Council Member Lynette McElhaney from the City of Oakland on the line with us, who's been kind enough to call in and weigh in. Thank you very much for being here, Ms. McElhaney. And you were an advocate in Oakland for so-called compassionate communities. And I remember seeing a TV report where the mayor of Oakland, Libby Schaff, was walking through the area with the tough sheds. They looked sturdier than tents. It looked neater and cleaner than tents. And on some level, this must have seemed like a good idea. I don't know if you were able to hear Nita B. and the concerns that she has around this approach. But what do you think about critics of the tough shed housing approach?
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Renee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. What we are experiencing is a heartbreaking evidence of a catastrophic economy that's hurting everyone at various levels, and it's going to take all that we can do to serve those who are struggling the most as we continue to work for a more just and moral economy throughout. And this is not an Oakland issue. This is an issue across our nation, and when we look at the displacement of people, it's a global issue. And that's what I've come to know better, and I'm continuing to be a student of this in the 5 years that I've been privileged to serve our city on the council. The Tough Shed model is yet one other kind of thought that we have lifted from other jurisdictions to say, how do we provide interim solutions that are more healthy and sanitized than the spontaneous camps that people are living in when they find themselves living outdoors? And I think that it's not a one-size-fits-all, not by any means, but it is a gigantic leap away from where we were in 2013, 2014, when I was really trying to press and push my colleagues to understand the crisis and to get the administration, then the Kwan administration, then the Schaff administration, to begin to think of innovative ways to do more than what we have been able to do. And I don't want to disparage the nonprofits that have been doing this work, most of whom grew up out of volunteer efforts or philanthropic efforts. When you look at BOSS, for example, it started as a Jewish volunteer effort coming out of their faith tradition to do kindness. When you look at the East Oakland Community Project or you look at Operation Dignity, all of these start and continue to rely upon donors and volunteerism. And then to begin to emerge, if you're not trying to do something on a sustained way, you find yourself caught in the insurance company and the state requirements and all of that. So I really don't want to speak in any disparaging way against any of the efforts that are out there. We just need to recognize that our economy is producing 2 new homeless people for every 1 person we get housed with all of the systems that we have. We are in a state where because of our very good and noble environmental quality standards and seismic standards, you know, we spend a lot more for a unit, and labor standards, I should add, to produce a unit of housing than other parts of the country. And it's expensive to build those doors that we want to provide for Hevera homes for people. So it's not simple. It's not, it's just extremely complicated and heartbreaking. And it's going to take everything we have, all that we know, and it's going to take innovation so that we discover the things that we don't know, and that we continue to push state, insurers, finance, zoning, all of it. I don't want to continue to just wax on and on, but that's kind of where I see the Outdoor Navigation Center. It's an extension of sort of known systems, working with known partners, and it will provide relief and support to some of the families that are living outdoors that will find themselves in a better situation in the camp. But this isn't a forever place, as the camps themselves are not forever places. These should be spaces where people find respite, get support, get help, and then move into better, more healthy housing situations.
Andrea Ertin, you're the CEO of Home First, and it is Home First's job to try to come up with a way to facilitate a proposed tiny home village in San Jose. And because we have Council Member Lynette McElhinney for only a portion of the program, I'm wondering if there are any questions that you have for Council Member McElhinney about what has worked in Oakland and what are some of the pitfalls that you might look for and avoid as you attempt to do something similar in San Jose.
Well, I thank you. That's a great question. There's a lot that's happening in San Jose, and one of the things that I really appreciate about our city council and about our mayor's office is we're actually looking at what is working other places. And so I think the city of Oakland, you know, really took a brave step, and they tried something. And I think that's what a lot of us can do, is see something that is happening somewhere else that is being relatively effective. We bring it to our community, and we try it here with the people that we serve to see if it works. We gather data, and then we use that data to inform our processes moving forward. We've been watching the Tough Shed project very closely. The Bridge Housing Project is not tiny homes. Let me be really clear about that. It is similar to the Tough Shed idea, where any given site will have 40 sleeping pods. Those sleeping pods, however, have insulation, electricity, a window that is large enough to get out of if need be, and then a functioning door. There will be a bed, a dresser, a table, and a chair with one outlet. So they're very, very minimal. The rest of the site will be consisted of shared living spaces, outdoor living spaces, barbecue space, shared bathrooms and showers, a shared very basic kitchen, shared meeting space. The Bridge Housing community is very similar to San Francisco's navigation centers. It is a place for people to step up from the encampments, to step into a safe temporary housing facility, to be reintegrated with society and the community, to find dignity and respect for themselves once again, and then be moved into permanent housing. Also, targeted resources will just be really heavily laid on these sites, so that there will be medical attention, there will be social services, there will be mental health, there will be case management, whatever these folks need to facilitate success in permanent housing will be provided to them.
You've been listening to four people who have been living and working with the homelessness issue in the Bay Area for years. You just heard from Andrea Erden. She's CEO of Home First. And I'm also interested in hearing what you have to say, Jennifer Friedenbach, because you've often looked at other models. Portland in 2000, going back some 17 years, they started an encampment of tiny homes, and they had a really novel approach, including the idea of having to invest sweat equity in keeping up the encampment. They have to pay a monthly fee so that they are invested in the progress financially, and the idea of an actual community meeting within the enclave. So some of the ideas have already proven to be tried and true, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the most successful models really value the autonomy in self-determination of destitute peoples, where they're able to set their own rules, they're able to, you know, basically set up the situation and self-govern. That way, you know, you're not going to make the kind of mistakes, and you're able to prioritize the things that are the most important to the people who are going to be living there. And I think that's where, in all of our homeless policies, where we've had success versus failure, can really go down to whether or not homeless people themselves took a leadership role in crafting the solution. I appreciated what council member said about diversity. You know, we have homeless folks who are very comfortable in a kind of an institutional shelter, where having a security guard and, you know, really rigid rules and all of that it feels really good and is something that works for them. And then you have other folks who that doesn't work for at all. And I think, you know, we really have to, of course, get to a place where we're investing in housing, and that has to happen at the federal government. And I think with this administration, people aren't too hopeful that we're going to be returning our housing funding back to, you know, pre-1978 levels and adjusting for inflation. And so in the meantime, we got to get creative. And the most creative and intelligent people are going to be the folks who are living this, because they're thinking about this all the time and what's going to work. And I think, you know, the fundamentals that we hear over and over again is access to water, places to, you know, wash your hands, being able to be warm, having bathrooms and showers. You know, these are things that are really, really important to folks, having garbage service. All that stuff is doable in pretty cheap ways. And, you know, that's where we really we can use these pre-development sites and have things going in a temporary basis that can really relieve the conditions, the really poor conditions that people are living under today.
Council Member Lynette McElhaney, before we have to let you go, I'm wondering if you can just weigh in on the fact that there still seems to be the issue of criminalization of homelessness, not so much within the encampments, but outside. Is the City of Oakland taking that on?
We are, and it's very, very complicated, as anybody can expect, that There's the criminalization of homelessness. There are some homeless people who are doing crimes, and we really need to address both of these issues to make sure that people are safe everywhere, whether you're in the camps. We've had assaults in the camps. We've had, you know, robberies in the camps. We've had robberies near the camps. It's human beings. So, we have to address the entire human condition and provide people the kind of support. I just wanted to lift up that it doesn't matter what the administration is. We really need to be bold and pressing and demanding that we get back to pre-1978 levels. This is our government. We need to make a demand on our government, and we need to not shy away from the fact that they may not be predisposed to hear our message. They weren't predisposed to hear the message of the Housing Rights Act in 1968. We had to press it then. We have to press it now. With as many of the laudable goals of the Obama administration, people know that I was very critical about the housing components of that administration and the Bush administration before that. We have got to really just begin to name this as the crisis and begin to challenge our most brightest minds around a fair taxation policy or economic policy, Federal Reserve policy. I don't know where all of the money flows go, but we have to get people thinking about this, because something is terribly wrong when people earning six figures have to live as roommates in an economy and call that affordable housing. It's not. I don't believe it's sustainable, and that pressure is being pushed downward, and we just don't have a healthy economy. So we are looking at all of it. I appreciate this portion of the conversation I've been able to hear. We have to address the issue around power and showers. We have to figure out better ways for us to hear our unhoused constituents so that we can get that wisdom infused into the operations and into self-governance. And I do want to lift up for our staff at the county and the city. We have been looking at best practices all around the region and all across the country, and using our limited resources, how we stretch those, we are, you know, continuing to push the mantle. There is an Oakland Leadership Council that's emerging with some of our private businesses, thinking about how they can help us fundraise and augment what we're able to do, because the dirt here is more expensive. And in my last thing, we all have to put a demand on the governor and on the state Caltrans agency to be better partners with us in liberating this land so that we can provide structured campgrounds where people can live autonomously for limited durations of time as they move themselves into more permanent, sustainable, and healthy options. We know from centuries of housing that living outdoors is not the healthiest way for human beings to live. And so my quest is that these are meanwhile solutions as we move to more permanent solutions for people to be housed autonomously in communities that provide them the opportunity to be fully human and fully expressed and in their most healthiest selves, with mental health supports if needed, with family supports, because we all need that, and, you know, with work and income that allows them to live fully. So I appreciate everyone, and I appreciate the opportunity to lift up the work that we're doing. It is a work in progress. Anybody who wants to get in touch with me with more resources or ideas so that we can elevate them to the mayor and to others, you can do that at lmcelhaney, L-M-C-E-L-H-A-N-E-Y, at oaklynette.com, Lynette GM, at Lynette GM on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook as well. But thank you all for this work, and we're going to continue to do as much as we can for as many as we can, as quickly as we can.
Oakland City Council Member Lynette McElhaney, thank you so much. As the only policymaker on the panel today, that was a very valuable insight. Thank you so much for joining us by phone. Still with us is Nita B., founder of Feed the People, Andrea Erton, CEO of Home First, and Jennifer Friedenbach, executive director of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness. We're going to take a quick break and take your calls. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Today we're talking solutions for homelessness. Coming up tomorrow, the topic is feminism in the year 2017. That word has perhaps taken on a whole new meaning with women's marches and sexual abuse charges, what's next in the quest for equality of the sexes. That's tomorrow on Your Call. You can listen to past shows, sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Give us a call at 866-798-8255. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness, Andrea Erton, CEO of Home First in Santa Clara County, and Nita B., a community organizer and advocate based in the East Bay. We have an email from Mike Wilson. Mike writes, if cities attempt to create solutions for homelessness, but the unhoused find these attempts to be worse than their current situation, then all the work and money invested in implementing these attempts is wasted. Those who need housing assistance must be a part of the process of determining what should be done. Jennifer Friedenbach, San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, Nina B. had brought up at the beginning of the show so eloquently, and absolutely has to be. And, you know, we've gone through different things in San Francisco where we've had really deep input from homeless people, where homeless people led the charge, and whether it was creating due process rights in shelters or changing over our shelter access system, or even early on in the creation of Community Housing Partnership, where was our one of our first supportive housing programs in San Francisco, where homeless people were able to get union cards and work on the buildings, and they were, you know, and continue to be a big part of running the operation. It's grown a lot larger now and has over, there's over 1,000 units that the organization has. But, you know, there's all these really beautiful examples of the best of the best of our homeless programs are really have homeless people themselves as a component, not just a component, but, taking leadership roles. And so in the Coalition on Homelessness, we operate that way everywhere, from our board to our staff to our we do extensive outreach to all of our campaigns. Their areas of work are led by homeless people themselves. And it's so critical and just can't be overstated.
And this might be a window of opportunity. The late mayor of San Francisco, Ed Lee, died, but one of his most embraced and cherished ideas, one of his final requests, was to fast-track the building of new shelters for homeless people. He wanted to declare a citywide emergency, but other folks contested that, and the vote got held up. So how do you see this moment in San Francisco's trajectory of working on real solutions on homelessness?
Well, we certainly need to expand our shelter beds, and we have about today we have about 1,400 people on the wait list for single adult shelters. On average, families are waiting about 111 days to get shelter. And, you know, those are the traditional shelters that are very structured and have a lot of rules and the security and all that stuff. For the, you know, we also have our navigation centers that a lot of people know about, which are basically what people would call low threshold shelters. And you can come and go, and there's no curfew, and the rules are a little bit looser. But, you know, in both of these models, you really don't have a lot of homeless people's leadership entwined in the design and the running and the overseeing of the programs and the deciding what rules should be in place. And, you know, they, you know, there's some, you know, a lot of stuff that could be better as a result. You know, right now we have navigation centers. One of our navigation centers, the main one, has a very short time limit for people to stay. And they hold beds for when they're going to do an encampment resolution and then move people into that. And for most of the folks who come into the navigation center, they end up back on the streets. And we hear from folks that they appreciate the respite, but we also hear that it's really traumatizing because you get a little bit of stability, you get a little taste of what it's like to have the access to the bathrooms and the showers and the decent night's sleep, and then the rug is just ripped out from underneath you. And so, you know, we've been pushing the city, and this is coming directly from homeless people, that they don't hold empty beds, that they release those, at least for short periods of time, for people to be able to use. And we also want to have a little bit more self-determination around length of stay, again, coming from homeless people. So, you know, there's a lot of different areas in the policy where we're falling short, where if we really engage the homeless community, we'd be a lot better off.
We have lots of callers who have questions. Let's start with Lou in Oakland. Hi, Lou.
Hi. Yes, this is Lou, and I have just a couple of comments. One is that we really need a team to put this homelessness solved, and it's not hopeless. It can be solved, but we're heading in the wrong direction. We keep looking to the cities and the counties for supplying an answer, and they can't do it. They haven't been supplying affordable housing, and that has to be a big part of the solution. They're not supplying the ability to get jobs or training to get jobs, and so that's part of the answer, and they're not doing it. And they're not doing any of the healing. People, as the last speaker said, are traumatized being out in the streets. And they're traumatized being separated from their homes and family. And healing trauma to people in trauma doesn't take 2 weeks, 2 months. It can take a year or more. And so we need to look for some other doing something different. And the thing different that needs to be done is to have groups that tie in all of the aspects of it, and let's look for private funding, not public funding. The public funding doesn't work. They've had their chance at it, and that's basically my summary.
Thank you, Lou. Andrea Erton of Home First. I have a hunch that as you go forward with the approach that your county is taking, that you've factored all of that in, things that have worked, things that haven't worked, using a holistic approach. I'm wondering if you have the same feeling that sometimes a bureaucracy isn't the best way to go. Perhaps it's about a compassionate outreach to nonprofits and even individual donors in coalition with a bureaucracy. What do you think?
Well, I agree in many ways with that. That, you know, there are challenges in working with a bureaucracy. However, if our system is flawed, we have to work within that system to create positive change, don't we? And that's the way to make it happen. So I think the approach to working with a coalition of people within and outside of the bureaucracy is really the way to find true systemic change. And that is hopefully what we're going toward in Santa Clara County, especially in the city of San Jose with the Bridge Housing Project. Mm. We've actually been working with the people who created Dignity Village and Opportunity Village in Eugene, Oregon. We've been learning from them what has worked. We've been working with homeless advocates, and we've been working with individuals who are challenged with being homeless to gather their input and their ideas on what they want to see the community look like. To me, that's the only way we're going to be successful in any of this.
Need to be. I'm wondering how much of a problem you've had with NIMBYs, people who might have compassion for what they see in terms of suffering and homelessness, but who say, yeah, but not in my backyard. Need to be, are you there? Okay, I think we lost Nita, but I think it's
that at Home First, we struggle a lot with people that are not in my backyard. They're worried about their property values. They're worried about the safety of their children. They want a bridge housing community, but they don't want it anywhere near where they live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're really working, again, with them, number one, to hear their concerns, to validate their concerns, but then also to kind of fight back with their concerns with facts. This is what a homeless individual looks like. This is, you know, we've got a group of people. The majority of the homeless folks that would be in bridge housing actually have jobs. Mm. You know, a lot of things that people don't know, that once they hear that information, it really, really helps kind of mitigate their fears.
All right, let's go to another caller. Hi, Robert in Richmond. Welcome. Robert in Richmond, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes,
hello?
Please. Yes, thank you. Go right ahead.
I have a cold. I just wanted to ask two questions. One is simple, I think. My partner and I would like to do something Christmas Day. We don't have anything else we're going to do. And if there's a suggestion as to what, we live in Richmond, what might be an actually useful thing to do to volunteer for the day or whatever, I'd like to get that suggestion. The second thing, though, is a minimal, more problematic. You know, I care a great deal, and I give money, you know, each year to food shelters and such. But when I'm approached on the street, or when I see somebody at a corner at a off ramp or whatever, I'm never sure if giving the money is going to actually end up in food or shelter, or it's going to end up in some kind of substance that, you know, shouldn't be. You know what I mean? Do you have any direction on anything like that? I mean, I've come to the rationalization that if I give to a food bank and a shelter, then I can kind of rationalize that I can tell them, go here, go there. I don't know.
Actually, those are both excellent questions. Let's start with the second one first. Jennifer, if there are folks who are wondering if they can, over the Christmas holidays, Christmas Day even, be of some actual real help, what would you suggest?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much people can do. I mean, whether it's doing a little mini coat drive and blanket drive and gathering them up from your friends and family and then giving those out, making sandwiches and giving them out, putting together some, you know, hot chocolates or, you know, that kind of thing, warm stuff to give out on Christmas. Socks are really, you know, really appreciated. You could also, you know, start a petition and go around on Christmas Day and get people to sign it, you know, calling for the City Council of Richmond to take homeless seriously and to, you know, try to find solutions to the issue. There's, you know, organizations in different communities that have different special hot meals. Those are tend to be the ones that have an overflow of volunteers. And so, you know, they're a lot of fun to do, but often filled up and not as needed. But yeah, there's a lot. And I think, you know, in terms of for us, for panhandling, and, you know, it's one of those situations where there's a comic strip that I have on my wall, and it's a guy that's about to hand somebody some money, and the guy says, "How do I know you won't spend it on drugs or alcohol?" And the guy responded, "How do I know that you weren't going to spend it on drugs and alcohol?" And so we kind of have this, you know, this thing where we pay people money and we don't question what they do with their money. But if it's in a panhandling situation, suddenly we question it. And I'm only saying that just to, you know, kind of prod a little bit. But I think, you know, once you give away the money, it's whatever, you know, the person's going to use it for themselves in the way that they need to use it. And when this issue's come up before, we've compiled and we've done outreach to homeless folks, asking them what they use their panhandling, money from and for. And it's a whole variety of things. People use it to try to get $10 to be able to pay a guest fee to stay in a hotel. People use it for toiletries or for shaving supplies. They use it for food. They use it for, you know, I mean, it's just a whole different gamut of things that we all need money for, a hot coffee. I mean, just, you know, and so we just, you know, at a certain point, we just got to let people decide for themselves. It's a visible reminder of poverty, and the person's out there because they're destitute. And it's really the most simplest, most direct human connection we can make, giving people the assistance that they're asking for.
I can see where hot meals and socks would be certainly appreciated, but there's also been an issue around people who are just coming and dropping off things, everything from furniture to loads and loads of clothing, and it's leading to a great deal of refuse, things that really aren't terribly usable. How much of a problem has that been, Jennifer? And then I'm coming back to you, Andrea. Jennifer?
Yeah, that's huge. You know, it's really a lot of people just, they'll just, you know, use it as kind of an encampment, as a cover to just dump stuff. Mm-hmm. And it ends up really hurting homeless people, because they then get blamed for creating that mess. And then they're much more likely to be victim of criminalization. And so it's really a bad idea to just dump all your surplus stuff. And it happens constantly. And then, you know, of course, a homeless encampment is not generating that much garbage. Of course, people are dropping stuff off, but folks don't think about it. They think that, oh my God, look, this big mess these homeless people created. And then the folks that are there at the encampment are stuck with trying to address it. What do they have the means to do it? They don't have trucks to bring it to the dump. They don't have the money for the dump fees. They oftentimes don't have access to brooms and garbage bags to clean it up. And so it just ends up making their entire encampment that much more unsanitary.
I'm wondering what our listeners think. Do you like the idea of the tough shed solution? It's a step up from a tent, perhaps. It's meant to be transitional. What do you think? Does it disturb you less to see someone perhaps in a tough shed than in a tent? What is a more permanent solution? 866-798-8255 is the number. Andrea Erton, CEO of Home First. It looks like the current tax bill could possibly cut funding even more for affordable housing. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, but I'm wondering how cities like San Jose, Oakland, San Francisco prepare to deal with possibly increasing numbers of people who might be slipping into homelessness if affordable housing goes down even more.
Well, one of the things that Santa Clara County did, which is similar to something that LA County did, is this past year we passed Measure A, which is $950 million that will be used for affordable housing. So we're one of the very lucky counties. We had leadership that made that a priority. I think they saw the writing that was on the wall, and they wanted to take steps to make sure that the most vulnerable in our community had options. Now, with that being said, that's fabulous they did that, but that permanent supportive housing is still another 5 to 10 years away from being built. So we are looking at options in the city of San Jose and Santa Clara County. We are looking at safe parking. As discussed, we've been looking at the bridge housing. We've expanded our cold weather shelters, and we've been implementing new shelters. So we're far, far away from solving this crisis of homelessness. But I really do think that we have leadership in our county and in the city of San Jose that's dedicated to being innovative and creative and looking at all options.
And I know that you definitely wanted to weigh in, Jennifer, on the question that we asked City Councilperson Lynette McElhinney, which is the criminalization of homelessness. She discussed both inside and outside the encampments. What's your concern and experience around this issue?
Yeah, homeless people, simply for the act of being homeless, are criminalized and given tickets for things like resting and sleeping, sitting. In San Francisco, it's been used as a huge wedge issue to get more conservative politicians' attention and drive more conservative voters to the ballot. It's, you know, we give out homeless people about 10,000 or more tickets. Oftentimes, they can't pay them. We have made some progress in San Francisco trying to address this. The number of tickets that homeless people are getting has been reduced fully in half. We got the courts to stop issuing warrants, which means that before, if a homeless person wasn't able to pay the fine or they missed the court date, the ticket would go to warrant and they would be jailed. And that's the way they'd pay off the warrant, is to do some jail time for being too poor to afford a place to live. And this is, you know, I mean, we're talking about paupers' prisons here. It's really outrageous. But this happens everywhere in the United States. And we've also seen situations where municipalities have done things like created safe encampments or, you know, created navigation centers or done these things and then use that as an excuse to increase criminalization that occurs against homeless people who are on the streets. And so, you know, basically the premise is that, oh, we've got options for some, so we're going to have zero tolerance for all. And that's something that it just ends up being counterproductive, because what we do is we move people from place to place, and it's traumatizing. They're incurring more debt. It often hurts their chances of getting into housing because they have bad credit and warrants. It disqualifies them for public housing. So there's all these negative consequences of it. We spend a ton of money on it. In San Francisco, we spent about $20 million last year just moving homeless people from spot to spot. The other thing it does is that it really, you know, it really ends up setting up this kind of fake response where, you know, people feel like the city's responding, but they're just simply moving people across the street. And it really frustrates both homeless people and drives up complaints in neighboring areas. So there's just a lot of harm involved in this, and it is really widespread throughout the United States.
Let's try to squeeze in one last call, and it's Arturo in San Francisco. Hi, thanks for hanging on, Arturo. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you, and thank you, Jennifer. I would affirm what you just said. I'm well acquainted with many of the people on the street, and warrants are a huge warrant. The police are in the habit of running warrants. They say that in order to run a warrant, and then if they find an offense, sometimes in the distant past, they'll have to arrest the person. They said they can't escape it. But in any case, what I really called about was the a rolling shelter, which is on display on 15th Street, just off Mission, and it's difficult to approach because all the one-way streets, but you can find your way back of the building. It's on permanent display. It's wheeled shelter, very attractive, and Amy Weiss, formerly a mayoral candidate, is behind it. Also, there was a homeless encampment right behind the College of the Arts along the Caltrain tracks, which was quite extensive and well-managed, and she was also associated with that. There was a fire in one of the shelters, and the city insisted not the following day on simply bringing in heavy construction equipment and destroying all those shelters. And I met some of those people. It was like the Rohingya fleeing Cambodia.
Wow, that's quite a comparison. Arturo, thank you so much for being our last caller. Sorry we couldn't get to everyone. It's one of those issues where everyone looks at this problem and has an idea of how it might be solved. Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of San Francisco's Coalition. I'm Renee Kemp. This is your call.